the assumption like, oh, if I do something, you know, unskillful, unwholesome, it's not that surprising. I'm a human being trying my best. I'm not a saint, even if that's maybe what I'm hoping to be and I'm working toward. But if I beat myself up over being imperfect, then I'm misunderstanding something about the nature of the universe and about the nature of myself as a flawed human being.
Hello, and welcome back to Religion to Reality, the podcast about living an integrated life. I'm your host, Dave Plisky, and I am joined by my friend and co-host, Father John Gribowich. This season is all about listening. And for us, as two Catholics, we are here to listen to what other faith traditions have to say. We're currently moving through a number of Buddhist guests. Last time we heard from Michael McCord, who situated Zen Buddhism within the larger Buddhism context and within some of the other traditions that it found itself alongside in East Asia. This time, we speak with Feta DeVries, whose focus within ancient Chinese Buddhism puts his area of expertise squarely at the time that Mahayana Buddhism was being localized into various unique Chinese schools, which included Zen Buddhism and a number of others. Let's get into that conversation. Today, we are joined by Feta M. DeVries. Feta is an assistant professor at Dharma Realm Buddhist University. His spiritual journey started early in his teens and led him to develop a deep connection with the City of 10,000 Buddhas, a monastic community in Northern California. He has also practiced and studied with various other Buddhist teachers and communities, both in the West and in Asia. Feta's interest in Buddhism also guided his academic trajectory. Feta holds a BA in Religious Studies from Leiden University in 2012, MA in Asian Studies from UC Berkeley in 2015, and a PhD in Buddhist Studies also from UC Berkeley in 2024. His academic research focuses on Chinese Buddhist scholasticism during the Sui and Tang dynasties. In 2024, Feta joined the faculty at Dharma Realm Buddhist University, a small liberal arts college on the campus of the City of 10,000 Buddhas, thus bringing together his Buddhist practice with his academic training. He teaches courses there in their academic programs, including courses that introduce students to meditative practices from the Buddhist tradition. Feta, welcome to the show. It's great to have you.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Absolutely. So I know you and John know each other, but you're new to me, and I'm sure you're new to most of our listeners. So I'd love to hear about, you know, kind of your life story, especially your kind of spiritual journey that we already mentioned. Just love to hear that path and what was happening.
Yeah, thank you. I guess I'll just start at, I don't know the beginning, but a beginning, which is when I was 12 years old and picked up a book in the library when I was staying over at my grandparents' place. It was a book, you know, one of those sort of informative books for children, introducing Buddhism, like, what do we know about Buddhism? And I picked it up and I wanted to bring it back. And so my grandfather was okay. And I still remember sitting on the, where I was sitting on the couch and how their couch was in their apartment back then, where I was reading about the Four Noble Truths, this Buddhist teaching of the Four Noble Truths. That really struck me, and that just kind of got me going on like an ongoing interest. Like I just kept pulling books out of the shelves in the library. Then when I got home, and scouring the internet for things that I could find, and then you know within a few years I found the City of 10,000 Buddhas, Master Shenhua, and his disciples, and you know my kind of. My standard joke is that when my dad had roughly stopped telling me bedtime stories, Reverend Hong Shir took over unknowingly. Reverend Hong Shir, I would download his talks, the MP3 files of that, put them on my, what do you call it back then? Not an iPod.
An iPod, right? Right?
Yeah, something to that. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, ancient technologies at this point. and listen to that before going to sleep.
Yeah.
I think an iPod's going to be like the hardest one to explain to a kid one day. It's like a CD makes sense. You're watching it spinning, like that is what is playing right now. And like, you know, the streaming, it's like, well, you just take it for granted. But an iPod makes almost no sense, right? Like, anyway, sorry, John, go ahead.
Well, actually, let's go back a little bit earlier just so we put a few things in context. Like, were you a spiritual seeker? Was that something that was kind of already ingrained within you, in you from a very young age, which is why you even thought it'd be interesting to learn about Buddhism from that book? Or was there religious practice happening within your family? Or like, how did you kind of see where this whole new pursuit of learning about Buddhism fit into your overall spiritual sense? Let's put it that way.
Yeah, I was, as I mentioned, this was when I was 12 years old when it started. So it's a little, you know, we're reconstructing a part of my life to which it's a little hard to have memory access.
Sure.
But
sure.
I think, I don't know if I was a spiritual seeker at that point. That would maybe be an overstatement. I definitely, so I did grow up with, you know, going to church with my parents in what I guess I would describe as a very liberal Protestant denomination church that for various reasons I was unsatisfied with. I just didn't feel at home there. I didn't feel I was kind of, you know, taught in the sort of Sunday school gatherings in a, you know, with our sort of preteen group in a way that made sense and was inspiring, nor also respectful of, I hate to say it, but respectful of my intellect. I was just like devouring information. I wanted something that would make sense. So that's one part of it. But I do remember, you know, in this Protestant liberal, you know, church was not very devotional, but I do have this very poignant memory of a few years before that. I must have been 8 or 10 that, you know, the children had some role in the church, and we were like, you know, holding a candle. And so I stood there in front of the church holding a candle, and my father afterwards remarking to me that I was like holding it with such sort of like devotion, so solemnly. So I think I've always had this sort of like natural sense of devotion and connection with the sacred, that, you know, that needed to find a place to go.
Yeah, and that's really beautiful. I mean, I was such an honor to be part of your wedding, because just the remarkable care and sensitivity and respect that you kind of showed in navigating an interfaith wedding ceremony with your wife Rosa, who's Catholic. Like, it was really to me lived religious dialogue in action, as how we, you know, or how I was able to witness that with both you and Rosa, and it was just beautiful. So I can see this type of reverence that you bring to things. And is there something within like your study of Buddhism that has now kind of amplified that for you, or augmented it in some ways? Like, how do you approach, let's just say, the world with that type of reverence? Like, what are we supposed to do when we discover that everything is to be reverenced in some type of way? Is that fair to kind of say that that's how you look at things? Or,
well, first of all, let me just, I mean, thank you for your role in the ceremony. I mean, I did a few parts putting together the liturgy, but
you did a lot, actually, but okay.
I mean, your input and sort of the energy that it brings, and your openness and sort of inspiration to be part of this interfaith ceremony, also made feeling this inspiration very easy. I guess, you know, I can answer. That's the problem with my mind. Like, I can answer, you see multiple levels at which to answer your question, and I guess I'll sort of start with what, for me, in some sense, is the easiest, the purely intellectual one, which is that in my, you know, PhD work, I actually started doing a lot of comparative work, just looking at the intellectual culture in the European Middle Ages as a way of thinking about what I was looking at in the commentaries of the Chinese great scholiasts, kind of inspiring the way I thought about them and their social context. And I learned a lot from that, including just seeing the openness in the debates among different great Catholic theologians. There were bounds within which you stayed, but there was real kind of space for debate that I also, then realized that these Buddhist sources also have. And I think maybe that does come in a way that's there. I might be jumping here a little bit, so you can help me flesh this out. But, in Buddhist sources, I really enjoy the way they really engage very seriously with their texts. These scholiasts, these scholar monks writing these commentaries, often performing these commentaries, as in like getting on a lecture sheet and like talking about a text, and even like having a debate partner sparring with them, that they really master the tradition, but were often not beholden to one single answer. So they take the tradition really seriously, but their taking it seriously includes a playfulness. And so I think, as I'm sort of working toward, finding my answer here to your question, it's like the, I mean, I find myself even doing this within Buddhist sources myself. I read these different things, and sometimes they're contradictory. And actually just enjoying seeing, like really taking this source for what it is and this text for what it is, and then feeling out how their difference might work out and actually inform me that that tension might actually be fruitful. And then similarly, like finding completely different kind of ways of approaching the world, some good, some bad, some maybe bad but good in a very particular context, and learning to see that with a sort of like learning to shift kind of how I see how I frame things. But approaching that as it were, with a sort of playfulness.
I want just as someone who doesn't know a ton about Chinese history, I would love to get in and feel free to make this as dumbed down as possible because we don't need a huge history lesson. But I wondered what was going on with Chinese Buddhism in the Sui and Tang dynasties that drew you to this, and I wonder like is that informing your practice of Buddhism in a way that might look different than others, the way others practice Buddhism because of your, kind of depth of knowledge about what was happening then.
Yeah, I think, now I'm hesitant to speak because of Buddhological colleagues that might listen into this at some point. So, but
No.
the way I would describe it is that they, during the Sui and Tang dynasties, we have Buddhism in China being taken really seriously by the Chinese intellectual elite. So there's a lot of funding, from the imperial court even for Buddhist monastic centers, especially with like a lot of high kind of high the Buddhist higher learning going on. It's very easy for monks. The court itself is often interested in Buddhist practice and Buddhist scriptures, funding translation projects, but also beyond the court, just a lot of intellectuals and literati. And so that's happening at the same time. There is still back and forth with, let's broadly say, with India, where Buddhism originates. So they're receiving Buddhist teachings, having these Indian masters come, but also having an already kind of like absorbed tradition in China. So we find instances of like, these very highly trained scholiasts being invited to help with the translation of a scripture. And then not because they knew Sanskrit, but because their Chinese was really good and they were really well-versed in Buddhist doctrine and how to expound Buddhist doctrine in Chinese. So they made a good sort of like native Chinese ear for fine-tuning the translation. And then bringing the translation into circulation and like, being able to explain it. As opposed to after the Tang and the Song Dynasty and so forth, where that contact with India dies out in a sort of fresh kind of like Indian interpretation, the coming of new scriptures. So we have this sort of very lively kind of like assimilation of Buddhism in sort of conversation with these masters who are actually visiting and almost checking the tradition and then fine-tuning it in terms of like being kind of in integrity with the Indian sources, which that sort of my own situation where I find myself is that the City of 10,000 Buddhas that I've been associated with for a long time was founded by this Chinese monk, this master who came from China, Master Xuanhua. And he was very kind of intent on bringing Buddhism to the West, making it available for Westerners who are interested in Buddhism, but also with a real sense of like being in integrity, being with the sort of authentic tradition, which of course is an ongoing debate, like what exactly is the baby and what's the bathwater, and even if we keep the baby, then we still need Western bathwater to kind of sorry, the metaphor is getting weird.
Yeah, I was like, please keep going. Where is this gonna happen?
But at this point in our history, we actually have a lot of Chinese or like Taiwanese, Vietnamese people in our community who are much more traditional than many of the Westerners who early on drew near to Master Xuanhua. And so it's an ongoing kind of dialogue, like, oh, okay, we have these practices that are in a very traditional Chinese form. And we have Westerners, and I myself am a Westerner. How do I relate to these practices? Do I kind of have to adapt them to myself? Do I not? Which is this ongoing kind of conversation that requires listening deeply to what kind of original intent might be, versus then finding what works for me. But
So what's
also
an
not just listening to myself, because then
yeah.
then
So
you
what's
become
an
bogged down.
example of something that one of these Asian people might be bringing from their tradition that might be different from kind of a person who's introduced in the West for the first time or something?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people who Westerners who come to Buddhism are very, they think of Buddhism as being about meditation. They might not think about Buddhism as being so much about what, in Asia over the centuries, most of Buddhism has been about merit making, doing good deeds, connecting with, the three jewels, with the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, such that one has good karma, such in the future, after one's death, one is reborn in good destinies. So people go straight away to meditation and miss all the sort of like, preparatory, very wholesome foundation that builds you as a person. So I'm thinking of like, practices like bowing, doing prostrations to the Buddha, or making, on your altar, like making offerings of flowers, of incense, of water, or sometimes of tea. That over time I personally found myself like discovering those practices and discovering the joy in them, of like, oh, it's so nice to actually just offer some flowers. That's really uplifting. Sometimes much more, or often much more uplifting, especially when I'm not doing well, than sitting in meditation and like sort of being very quiet.
That's such an interesting thing. I mean, because as you know, in Roman Catholicism, there's so much ritual, and a lot of times I think even Catholics kind of scratch their head, thinking like, "I'm not really quite sure why we're doing this or why this is so important." But to kind of discover the ritual and be able to see how of value it is to your way of just showing up in the world. I mean, that's a great lesson for anyone who's part of a religion that emphasizes ritual. Because what does it feel like for you, like when you are offering flowers on, say, your altar, your personal altar, what's going on there? Like, what are you offering flowers to, or like, how do you integrate that whole expression?
I think, yeah, the way I would describe how it feels to me is, you know, I actually like to think about the analogy of like doing these things in our own daily life. So, you know, if you have a loved one and you bring something to them that they like, you know, I give flowers to my wife and she lights up and she's so happy. You know, you receive a guest and you offer some water, and just like there's this appreciation for this act of generosity. And just going like, you know, look, the altar is represented, is present on, or sorry, yeah, the sacred, or, you know, the Buddha is represented, is present, and that stands on my altar. And, you know, then by an act of imagination, like the Buddha is really just sitting here. And if I put a flower there, like I can have the sense of like, oh, the Buddha's happy receiving with me making this offering of a flower. And, you know, when I give my wife a rose, she lights up and then I myself feel very happy, right? So that kind of analogously, like when I offer flowers, like, oh, this is so nice. Like I feel uplifted doing this.
It's really beautiful.
Or for that matter, like, you know, it's in some sense easier to imagine just with serving our monastic community. You know, have vows of celibacy and poverty, or in sense they at least don't have an income. And there's many things that they're not able to do by virtue of their rules. So sometimes just offering a walk, you know, offering them water, or like letting them walk, you know, walk first.
What is your relationship to the monastic community?
As in what my own?
Well, you said like, so serving the monastic community, is this the place where you go and you spend time on a regular basis, or you have relationships with them, or is it more just when you happen to be there, you want to make sure that they're taken care of? Like, I just wondered what kind of regular contact do you have with the place and with the people?
Yeah, I find myself in a very blessed situation. I mean, the Sangha and the monastic community in the Buddhist tradition is considered a field of blessings, and just being able to see monks and nuns out on the street is especially here, is a rare sight. But it just that seeing them, like those symbols of peace and renunciation, is understood to be really kind of like wholesome. So I consider myself very blessed because I have colleagues who are monks and nuns. I have students who are monks and nuns, and I'm around, you know, teachers who are monks and nuns. Just working at Dharmarang Buddhist University at the City of 10,000 Buddhas, you know, there's monks and nuns living there. Some of the other faculty are monks and nuns, and then some of the students.
Gotcha.
And so there are occasions when we have, you know, monastics come to visit, or when, you know, when I'm helping to host someone, or just when we have a meeting and there's like a tiny little thing that I can, you know, that I can do to make life easier for them.
You mentioned that there are foundational aspects of Buddhism that the West seems to be sort of skipping over and going straight to certain practices like meditation. Is there a danger in moving straight to meditation without starting with those other things, or how do you feel about people kind of taking pieces of, you know, Buddhism without the whole?
I love that question. Or those two questions. How do I feel about Buddhism, people taking pieces and instead of the whole? In some sense, I feel it's inevitable and people are going to do it and we need to do it. There's ways in which I practice at home that's very different from how the monks and nuns practice, you know, in the Buddha hall. Which is to say, like, I prefer to sit down on the ground as I do my practice, whereas they do their ceremony standing, which just gets into my back real badly. But I do really think there is a danger in throwing things out too easily without a sense of discernment, especially a lot of these, you know, things that kind of rub against us as Westerners or modern people. Because nowadays one doesn't just find these kind of preconceptions with Westerners, but a lot of Asians who come to Buddhism have the same expectations, you know, or like meditation, like deep insight. I mean, I think a lot of the basic teachings of Buddhism are about, again, karma and merit making, or like wholesome connections, honoring your family, like having wholesome friendships that provide a lot of, how do I put it? I mean, just like foundation for good mental health. And a sort of, to speak slightly more in Western terms, like, they divide a sort of provide elements for a virtue ethic that would help you lead a flourishing life, regardless of whether or not you're like intending to attain full freedom from suffering, by deep meditative insight. And I have found personally, just to make it very personal, that in periods when I was, say, struggling with depression or panic attacks, meditation, silent meditation, was often not the answer. Sitting quietly for 45 minutes or an hour, letting my thoughts arise and cease and just breathing through all of it. When there's, say, suicidal ideation going on, it's not, it doesn't help. It doesn't help. But in those situations, going like, oh, I can make offerings to something that feels uplifting. Or oh, I can make prostrations in a sense of purification, laying down the burdens and lifting myself up. I find like, oh, I can like be in the presence of the Buddha and like, these kind of honored figures. It's like, oh, I'm actually safe. I'm held. Like there's care for me in the universe.
That's really beautiful. It's very hopeful too. I mean, because there is just this seeming, there seems to be an assumption that meditation can solve everything, And at least my practice, my understanding of Zen and the way I like to practice Zen, and I'm specifically talking about Zen here, is that it could be anything. Anything is really a Zen moment. If you just simply look at it that way, I mean, and then there's tremendous, there's a tremendous effect from that, which is difficult for a lot of us because I think we think that, ritual and practice has to look a certain way and you should do it as often as you can. And that kind of shows that you have like a thread work, moving through your life that makes it identifiable with some type of, let's just say, belief system or whatever you want to call it. But to have something that's not as orthodox as that type of approach, let's just call it that, sounds kind of risky, and it sounds almost like you're kind of making it up as you go. But like in some ways you are, and there's maybe nothing wrong with that. I mean, at least that's the what I'm picking up from how you're saying it. I mean, if I'm saying something that doesn't, gel with you, I mean, just, you can say, but that's what I'm hearing.
Yeah, I mean, I think in some sense, we're always making it up as we go. We're offered these tools that, that we can use.
Absolutely.
Now, it's sort of my kind of my warning that I think Dave was picking up is like sometimes there are tools in our toolbox that we shouldn't discard because they might be extremely helpful, and we shouldn't discard them because we're biased toward them. But we need some playfulness to figure out which tools are necessary when they're, given the circumstance.
Right. I like how you use that word playfulness a lot. What does that mean to you when you say that?
Joy and curiosity, feeling things out, like a sense of lightness, but a lightness that like also takes things really seriously. I mean, in my dissertation, one of the chapters, chapter four, which I don't expect any of you or your listeners to ever read, but I actually explicitly compare what the great commentators in the Sui and Tang dynasty were doing in their commenting on scripture with jazz. And I think, jazz musicians improvising, you take very seriously the things that, the musical tradition has handed you, and you play with them, right? You find new ways of working with it. You don't throw the entire thing out, then no one else in the band knows what you're doing. And that provides, that's the other side of it. That provides a sense of safety. So there's the tradition which has given us all these tools. that is kind of present and that that offers me a safety within which I can play.
Do you think Buddhism is particularly helpful for that sort of approach to spirituality where you're given a strong tradition, but you have a lot of freedom to play within it?
I don't think I would claim that for Buddhism. I think, as I said earlier, part of what helped me realize this about the Buddhist tradition was reading about scriptural exegesis and commentaries in the European Middle Ages. I think maybe at some points they exemplify it, kind of, especially just as one instance has come to mind is the great master Chan Guan, this commentator, 8th, 9th century, writes a preface to his great com you know to a long commentary that he writes, and then a decade or so later he writes a sub commentary on his own preface, which was in verse, and there's elements of that where he gives incommensurable explanations of the same word, of the same line. You're like, wait, didn't you mean a single thing? He's just like, well, here, let me explain it this way. Let me explain it this other way. Both are valid. So there is maybe a, there's a focus on sort of non-attachment ultimately, and like attaching to views is considered, unwholesome as something that leads to suffering. But I tend to think of tradition as properly understood, and as opposed to fundamentalism, as intrinsically being about or containing an element of play, and giving space to play.
What are your students like? Are most of them coming in already, Buddhist and practicing Buddhists, or are they experiencing Buddhism for the first time sometimes? I just wonder, what's that experience like for you?
Our students are great. That's the first answer. And more to your question, they're very diverse, in all sorts of ways. We have three academic programs. We have a translation program, a master's program, and a master's. And the master's is in Buddhist classics, and the BA is in liberal arts. The translation program, we translate Buddhist texts. It's a translation, Buddhist translation program. The MA in Buddhist classics tends to attract people who are specifically interested in Buddhism and want to spend 2 years reading Buddhist texts. So they're from all sorts of Buddhist traditions. Some are more kind of on the agnostic kind of exploring side. Some are very kind of traditional devotion, devoted Buddhists. The undergraduate program, which really is an undergraduate in liberal arts, where they study Buddhist classics every semester, but also they study Chinese classics, Western classics, Indian classics, science. They work through Euclid. But the people coming in there, they know that they're coming to a Buddhist university, and they know that the curriculum includes contemplative practice. But it's not. There's no requirement that you're Buddhist. There's no expectation that you convert to Buddhism. There's just sort of an assumption as you apply that you are interested in exploring contemplative practice. We have students from all over the world and students from various religious traditions, including very Christians from various denominations, atheists, and Buddhists from different traditions.
Is there anything that's particularly surprising to people who are encountering, these Buddhist texts or Buddhism for the first time? Is it anything that stand out to you that's, a little different?
I think I'll dodge that question by saying different. People have different experiences.
Sure.
I think one thing that, just going back to the theme of sort of like, the modern American encounter with Buddhism, one thing that people are sometimes kind of shocked by, and like takes them a while to adjust as they are living on our campus, is that, they might have sort of a very Western romantic view of, Buddhists living together, a 60s intentional community where everyone's very open-minded. And then, it turns out this is a tradition that in many ways has very old-fashioned views on all sorts of things that can make people quite uncomfortable. There, I maybe shouldn't go into specifics, but yeah, this sort of realization that there is, traditionalism in Buddhism and millennia-old views that still inform people and that people still practice within.
You said, you said you don't have the expectation that people would convert to Buddhism. And I was a little surprised when you said that because my understanding is that in Chinese society, that there wasn't there that Confucianism and Taoism and Buddhism just sort of coexisted in a lot of ways. And then it was a little bit more fluid. People weren't as most times people weren't picking and choosing. And so I got the sense, at least in the Chinese understanding of Buddhism, that you wouldn't necessarily convert to Buddhism. You just sort of adopt some of those ideas and practices and so forth. Well, first tell me if that's true, and then I'm curious, like, is that not really how it's practiced where you are, or I just wondered.
No, I mean, I think that's definitely true in most of not all of Buddhist Asia. Its religious identity is a lot more fluid than Western categorizations tend to make them out. I think at the same time, in the Buddhist traditions, there are acts of formally taking refuge, or formally taking precepts, or one might become a monk or nun, which do, to various degrees, mark you as kind of primarily identifying as a Buddhist. Even as one continues maybe making offerings to, say one's ancestors in a sort of Confucian way, or reading Confucian classics in a very serious way. There are ways of being, quote unquote, more formally, a Buddhist within the Chinese or Indian or Japanese cultural context. So that's part of the answer. So yes, I think you are correct there with that caveat. But then in the Western context, when people encounter Buddhism, especially if they come from a Christian background, or even if they're like atheist or agnostic, like, I don't want to become a Buddhist, right? I'm a Christian. So then, right, like, they might have this feeling like, oh, should I, like, are they expecting me to convert? I was like, no, we're not expecting you to convert. Now, of course, I mean, we're talking about it exactly in the way that you put it. Like, if there are things here that you find valuable, please take them. I mean, just like, frankly, I'm taking things from other traditions that I find valuable and help me understand the Buddhist tradition better, help me understand the world better, my life better. I mean, like, on that note, like, in sort of working on the wedding ceremony, to bring it back to the way Father John and I met, and reading, about the Catholic understanding of marriage, I gained a clarity there that the Buddhist tradition hadn't been kind of offering in the same way.
Tell me a little bit about the history of the Buddhist Catholic dialogue within your tradition, because I know that you mentioned that with me. Maybe you can unpack a little bit about that.
The founder, Master Xuanhua, developed a very close friendship with Cardinal Yubin, was a Catholic cardinal who came from the very same village as Master Xuanhua. And the two of them, would talk. And there is this Cardinal Yubin founded the Furun University, where just a month or so ago, we had visitors from Furun University in Taiwan visiting us here in Ukiah. And that's a Catholic university, and we feel, kind of very, very close with them. And over the years, our monastics have had various gatherings with Catholic monastics and priests, engaging in interreligious dialogue. Yeah, and Master Xuanhua famously made a sort of promise with Cardinal Yubin, like, oh, if I will be the Catholic among the Buddhists, and you can be the Buddhist among the Catholic. Among the Catholics.
I like that when you express it that way. That's interesting.
Are there things that you and your wife are learning from each other's traditions that you that you've noticed?
I mean, one thread that's that proceeds, you know, that, that stems in my reading from my research, but is you know, that that has quite deeply informed the way I think about Buddhism and my Buddhist practice and Buddhist community, is the way that the Catholic Church has put this emphasis on not just the scripture is authoritative, it's scripture plus tradition. Mm. And tradition is a complicated conversation. Mm. Which, you know, then I go like, it's a kind of playful conversation and continuous adaptation. I think, you know, the wedding was just 3 weeks ago, and it's still we're still digesting things. And
sure. So there's definitely a sense. I didn't realize like it was so recent. Yeah.
Oh, thank you, thank you. Yeah, definitely a sense of like the meaning and the sacrality of marriage that I think the Catholic Church teaches, where sometimes in, you know, in some Buddhist communities, you know, there can be a feeling of like, oh, like household life is a little bit of a plan B. You really ought to become, you know, a monk, meditate, and have the highest spiritual attainments and meditate a quiet dude. Whereas I think, you know, the Buddhist tradition does have all this kind of teaching on developing compassion, developing love and kindness, developing this boundless heart that like encompasses all living beings, which I feel, to criticize the Buddhist tradition, sometimes can be a little abstract. Like, oh, like I care about all living beings. So, you know, we, in kind of preparing for the wedding ceremony and doing some of the Catholic readings, and also talking with Father John, this idea of like, you know, marriage as, you know, a training ground where you really get to fine-tune your capacity for love, develop and expand that capacity for love, which then ultimately is not just, you know, for your partner, but it grows out into the entire world, grows to encompass the entire world.
And more deeply into yourself as well at the same time.
Mm. And so there's ways that the Catholic tradition, I think, articulates that, that that I don't think I had quite realized. The other thing actually is Father John recommended The Divine Dance by Richard Rohr. You know, because I want to read some, you know, Catholic texts before, you know, before we get married with a Catholic, you know, with a partially Catholic ceremony and inspiration to it. And, you know, there you know, exploring the Trinity and especially the kind of like the sacred as intrinsically being in relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And which got me thinking about like, hey, that's actually true in Buddhism as well, but we never talk about it that way.
Mm-hmm.
None of the sacred things in Buddhism exist without their relationship to each other, or to, you know, what we would say, you know, living beings.
Yeah. Since it's interesting that you just brought up Richard Rohr, just because when you mentioned, you know, the Catholic idea of how important both scripture and tradition are, he adds one more element, which he would say is maybe even more important, or at least important to lead with, which is experience, personal, you know, your own personal experience, which is, I think, kind of implied all the time, but often not named. Because let's be honest, like if you didn't give honor to your own experience, how could you even ever encounter the tradition or the scripture in the first place, right? Like it's you. There's some kind of phenomenological thing happening that is allowing you to even do that in the first place, right? Mm-hmm. And you're trusting that that's good for you, you know?
Yeah,
I mean, we name the conscience, but we don't often name our experience.
Yeah, and the sort of deep fundamental human qualities that we are cultivating. Like we are connecting with something. I mean, I think early on in the conversation I spoke about this like natural, you know, devotion that I felt even as a young child. And, you know, that is there. And religious practice, spiritual practice helps grow and expand that. which you couldn't do if it wasn't already there in some way. We're also dealing with all sorts of crappiness, you know, like, you know, bad karma from previous life, or I think, you know, the Catholics might have a different term for that, which is real, you know, real, but there's also all this goodness inside that we can tap on. And if you don't have that experience of an open, of a heart opening, then using religious tools to open your heart, I think it's just, you know, you're in the dark grabbing around you.
Yeah. You can make parallels to that with like notion of original sin in Catholicism, you know, that we all are fundamentally good, yet we inherit something from the foundation of the world too, that, that allows things to exist within us that we're not personally responsible for, but we have to still contend with.
Which, you know, actually oddly is another aspect of Catholic teachings that sometimes that that I will think about sometimes and give me some solace, the idea of original sin. Which, yeah, again, like, you know, just thinking in Buddhist terms about, you know, all this negative karma that we carry and all these habitual tendency to, that we have. But the assumption like, oh, if I do something, you know, unskillful, unwholesome, it's not that surprising. I'm a human being trying my best. I'm not a saint, even if that's maybe what I'm, you know, hoping to be and I'm working towards. But if I beat myself up over being imperfect, then I'm misunderstanding something about the nature of the universe and about the nature of myself as a flawed human being.
Yeah, that's a great way into self-compassion, right? That compassion that you have for others has to be extended also, and maybe first to yourself.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Maybe even one way of saying that is if you don't yourself have the experience of wishing yourself well and like being happy yourself, then it's kind of meaningless to wish other people to be well and happy.
Yeah, we can't give what we don't have. Well, as we close here, I wanted to ask you about your practice of listening. This season is inspired by our guests from the previous season, who over and over were telling us how important listening is, how sacred listening is, and so we like to ask our guests now, how do you cultivate a practice of not just any kind of listening, but maybe listening without agenda? How do you do that in your life?
I think it starts in the same place for me. When I am in situations where I really need to listen to someone deeply, to really kind of center myself, right? Be in my own body, find my own center, relax as, you know, as much as I can. Even kind of physically opening, you know, the heart, opening the shoulders rather than hunched over, ready for the next thing. And continuing to breathe. I find if I don't start from the kind of physical centeredness, from the groundedness, from that space, then it comes with all these kind of like tendencies to overlay. But if I start with a sense of openness and like relaxation in my own experience, like the new things are safe, and I can be open to someone else bringing in what they're bringing in. And I think it also kind of goes along with, sorry, my earlier theme of like, you know, playful seriousness or serious playfulness. Like when someone's saying things that I don't know, understand or don't know yet, I don't have to immediately have a judgment or like a response to it or a way of putting it in my own worldview. I can just let it be and let it simmer because it will kind of work itself out.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's beautiful.
I love what you just gave us because it's something that's so incredibly practical. You know, everyone comes with their body, you know, to any situation of listening, more than their ears, right? As you're saying. And so it's so totally applicable to every situation. So thank you for that.
Yeah, beautiful.
Well, thank you so much for having me. This was delightful.
Yeah, it was great. It was great to have you. Thanks. Thanks, Feta. Well, I'm sitting up straighter. I'm so pleased that no matter what walk of life our guests are coming from, they're able to articulate their practices clearly and make them applicable even to those outside their tradition. Feta is a scholar and an academic, but I find he mostly just comes across as a down-to-earth person. It's very warm and welcoming. Next time, we're going to hear from our guest, Eva Natanya, who is an incredible combination of Buddhist and Christian. She manages to hold them both so well and speaks about it so eloquently. I love this comic. I know I say this every single episode, but it's true. I love all these, and you should too. So please join us next time for Eva Natanya. Religion to Reality is a podcast, but it's also a monthly interfaith gathering. You can join us online for free. The sign up for the interfaith gathering is available at our Substack, which you can find at religiontoreality.substack.com. Religion to Reality was created and is executive produced by me, Dave Plisky, and is produced and edited by Nick Strapoli and Connor Donnelly. You can find the show notes and other resources at religiontoreality.org. Subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.